Self-compassion is not selfish at all. Self-compassion gives you the freedom to love and appreciate yourself as you are, so that as you move into that space of self-compassion, you can then be of service better to everyone else.
Hi, and welcome to Lead Well, the podcast for you if you want to get better at leading yourself and leading others. This is Christine Schickinger, your host, looking into how you can achieve peak performance while keeping a peaceful mind. Hi, and welcome to today's episode of Lead Well. I have a wonderful guest with me. So let me introduce you, Amy. Amy Patty Colvin is a dedicated facilitator and coach who specializes in helping individuals cultivate compassion, inner peace, and resilience. And I see a bit of a similarity here between us. That's just wonderful. Amy's journey began in the mid-1990s with Samvat meditation. We'll definitely have to talk about that. A unique blend of Taoism, Buddhism, and Confucianism, and has since evolved into a profound passion for personal growth and transformation. Amy is a certified facilitator of Stanford University's Compassion Cultivation Training. Again, something we need to talk about. And has touched countless lives through her coaching and courses. In 2024, so last year, she launched Body Mind IntelliSense, a groundbreaking 12-week program blending ancient wisdom with modern neuroscience to reduce stress and enhance emotional well-being. Amy also leads international spiritual tours. I'll definitely want to learn more about that. Guiding participants on journeys on self-discovery and cultural immersion. Her mission is simple but powerful: to help individuals embrace their authentic selves, cultivate compassion, and live a life filled with purpose and joy. And I know when we had our first conversation, you gave me your mission statement. I think that was it, which really touched my soul. You said, "I help and teach people how to be free from the inside out." What a wonderful thing. Hi, Amy.
Yeah, hi. It's so nice to be with you here, Christine. Thanks so much for inviting me to have another conversation with you and to share ideas with the folks that are listening in.
So your bio said your journey started with Samvat meditation in the 1990s. So how did that shape your approach to coaching and facilitation today?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, honestly, I think that my experience with this meditation path has completely transformed everything about how I live my life, how I view the world, what I want to share with other people. And through the grace of my sister, she invited me back in the mid 90s. Hey, I'm going to this meditation workshop. You've got to come. She'd been with that teacher for maybe 4 years before me. And you can tell by my accent, I'm in the United States. And it's a type of meditation that's not particularly common in the United States or really anywhere in the world, unless you are in Malaysia. So the Samvat meditation itself started in Malaysia, and you will find temples that relate to that in Malaysia and a couple in Thailand. But the essence of it, through blending Taoism, Buddhism, and Confucianism, the essence of it is teaching people how to integrate spirituality into every day. So it's not, and it's very much the middle way, like the Taoist path is very much the middle way. And it also teaches us that all human beings have the ability to connect with the divine within, their higher self. And through that deepening of connection with our higher selves, we then become the best human beings that we can be as we live this everyday life. And I could tell you story after story, but the connection to this path has shaped my world in that I grew up being a very fearful kid. I grew up thinking I was invisible. I grew up spending a lot of time in my closet hiding. I was prone to situational depression, and all of that is gone. Now, it's not a magic bullet. It's not going to, happen immediately, but the tools within this particular style of meditation, because we're embodying what we learn, we're integrating it into everyday life. We're not intellectualizing it. We're not sitting in a cave in the mountains, isolating ourselves. We are living an everyday human life while connecting with our higher selves. That ability to integrate all of that with whatever you have going on in your own life and your own personal history is an opportunity. It creates an opportunity for you to grow beyond that and turn into something really wonderful. And as you said in my mission statement, really embrace that idea of setting yourself free from the inside out.
Wow. And it's needed much more now than ever, I would say that we,
Absolutely.
I mean, I.
Absolutely. I mean, I think so much of the fear and the anxiety we see in the world around us is people being tuned into external factors, politics, nature, whatever it might be. That people are so outwardly focused and they're paying attention to what's going on, and people are often on high alert. It's like, okay, let's bring that back down to the inside. Let's see what we have on the inside that we can allow ourselves to extend outward.
Yeah, also it reminds me of one of the coaching techniques or approaches that I'm using. Positive intelligence, where we call the higher inner self the sage, and everything that distracts us, the saboteurs. And we can only really make a good decision when we're making it from our higher self's perspective, because everything else is off. That's
Right. And that sounds simple, but it's not easy, right?
exactly. It takes time, it takes practice.
Right. And from the sum thought path, it's rather than so, and I suspect from the positive psychology path, you don't suppress and deny the saboteurs. You don't suppress and deny your little self. You honor it. You say, I see you, but I'm not going to let you take over my world.
Exactly. I mean, what I usually do, I imagine them as little figurines, little people sitting on my shoulder, and I just tell them, well, not now. You can wait. Stop talking to me. And so wow, that's
Yeah.
great. So
And that's really cool because that's exactly what I do. You know, I've got one in particular that sits on my shoulder and yells at me about a certain topic, not very often, but he's the one that crops up and I'm like, okay, I hear you, I see you, I'm not gonna let okay. And sometimes those saboteurs have words of wisdom and good ideas. And it's like, oh, you mean I really shouldn't walk off that cliff? Okay. Thanks for giving me a warning and telling me I'm going down the wrong path there. But being able to differentiate who you are as a human being and these saboteurs or the little selves so that we can live and grow and learn from this central place, honoring the messages from these creatures on our shoulders, but not letting them take over.
Yeah, wonderful. So I also read in your bio that you have created Body Mind Intellisense program. So you're saying that it's a unique blend of traditions and science. Could you share an example of how neuroscience complements these ancient practices in your program?
Yeah, oh, there's so much to unpack there. So I'm going to make this a long answer, but I'll try to keep it concise. So this whole notion of Sumphot meditation, that is very much a process of being rather than thinking. And I first started teaching meditation and Qigong when I was working at Google, and I realized that in order for me to connect well with the minds, the engineering minds that were at Google, I needed to be able to say something a little more than, Okay, just trust me and do what I'm telling you to do. So I ended up getting involved with the program at Stanford, which was the Compassion Cultivation Training. And that program, the CCT program, Compassion Cultivation Training, was designed specifically to be secular and science-based. And Dalai Lama actually put a portion of his own personal finance into the development of that curriculum. And so that's where I really started thinking about the science involved with meditation and the neuroscience that goes along with that. For example, I've already talked about how much this meditation path has changed me, right? So, one of the things that is absolutely true is researchers are realizing, and you know this because you know much more about the scientific aspects than I do, but researchers are realizing that people brains are neuroplastic no matter their age. It used to be that it was like, oh, little kid brains are neuroplastic, adults aren't. But that's not true. And so the ability to expose yourself to new ideas, the ability to expose yourself to new ways of thinking can create changes in the brain. And so, for example, in this Body Mind Intelligence program, it's a 12-week program with daily lessons. And part of the reason why we have daily lessons in there is that notion of reinforcing, 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 so that eventually you can begin to have those neurons fire together until they get wired together. So it's not just a quick fix. It's not like, here, read this and then go off and forget about it. It's, hey, let's do this. Let's do this every day. Let's create a pattern. Let's create a habit. And the more we reinforce those habits, we can begin to create those shifts.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense because these days we often are looking for the quick fix, but research knows that we need at least 21 days, if not 60 days to 90 days, to reshape our brain, as you said, to
Right.
rewire it and create new habits.
And so the other thing that I think makes Body Mind Intelligence particularly unique is, so let's just unpack the name for a minute, Body Mind. So it's body and mind. We're integrating those two things along with heart and spirit and IntelliSense. So it's not just intelligence, it's that sensory perception. And what I really highlight in that program is, I mean, obviously you can see by the way I'm waving my hands around that I'm a kinesthetic person and I'm a kinesthetic learner, and that suits me really well. But integrating movement through Qigong with mindset change really helps cement that much more firmly. And so I was listening to someone the other day, a neuroscientist whose name has just completely escaped me, but he came up with this. He told this great story about this aquatic creature called a sea squirt. And the sea squirt, when it's born, it has a tail so it can move around, it has a spinal cord so it can sense things, and it has a brain so it can think. And its whole goal in its first 72 hours of life is to find a place where it can anchor in and spend the rest of its life. Not really sure how long that life is, but once it anchors in, it begins to eat its spinal cord and it begins to eat its brain. So his premise is that if we get anchored in and settle down and surround ourselves with only things that we know and we don't ever move, we too will begin atrophying our brain, atrophying our ability to even think about expanding into the world and doing something big and different. And so I like that idea because he's saying that neuroplasticity comes from moving. I mean, there's enough brain science, and you could speak to this more than I can, about how movement keeps the brain young, healthy, fluid, growing, dynamic, have the ability to change. And also, in addition to moving, being exposed to something more than your current spot. So, having conversations with people who have different opinions than yours and being able to listen to them without needing to persuade them to your way of thinking. Having that open-mindedness and open-heartedness to listen to alternative ideas, to not necessarily that you have to change your mind, but be that willingness to expose yourself to a variety of places, thoughts, so on and so forth, helps our brains stay flexible, helps us train our brains. And that's again one of the reasons too why I love taking the work that I do into international travel. Because we're immersing ourselves in new cultures, new places, which stirs up those old ruts so that you can actually learn better.
And it is up to us to actually look for new environments, look for new impulses. Because, I mean, having worked at Google, you know it better than me that online we're all living in a bubble, if we want it or not. So there is not that much new information that's coming our way. We literally have to go out and look for it.
Well, and especially these days when the algorithms are so well curated and so well defined, whether it's Google, whether it's YouTube, whether it's anything at Facebook, it's like you are fed the stuff it thinks you want to see. So you're absolutely right. I mean, if we spent our time solely on devices, we'd never, I mean, you and I would never have met if it weren't through interacting with other human beings.
Absolutely. So open the mind. And the interesting thing when you talked about movement and the brain, it's so fascinating in this other method that I'm using, the trust technique. We noticed, and we use that, if we keep still, we cannot think.
Oh, interesting.
Because thinking is movement. It's really so mind-blowing if you start looking into the details there.
So tell me just a real quick question. What do you mean by thinking is movement?
you have to move to be able to think, especially your eyes. And you cannot even see if your eyes don't move. So your eyes are doing these micro movements. And if, for example, there was a researcher who did this study, this experiment, where she attached little images to the eyeballs of people, and they could not see it because the eye has to move to see things.
Oh,
And you
that's
have,
amazing.
yeah, it's really amazing. And I think that we're living in a really good time because science is going so deep and is unveiling so many interesting findings these days. And I'm passionate about animals, as you can say. So even in the animal behaviorist studies, up until 10 years ago, you would not be allowed to talk about animals having emotions like humans have. So the perception there was there is the animal world, there is the human world. And now we know, and science is proving that there is no border. We are just the same. We're just living beings. And animals have emotions, animals have feelings just like we have.
Yeah, and what's interesting to me about listening to you say that is that's the way I've always felt. And so it's interesting to think that it's just science is validating this just in the last decade. But going back to other cool scientific things, one of the studies that really stuck out for me when I was going through the program at Stanford, which was 8 years ago or so, is the idea there was new research coming out that when a person spends time in meditation, their telomeres lengthen. And, you know, telomeres are what help us have longer, healthier lives. And it's like, holy cow. I mean, these days it seems like it makes total sense. Okay, you want a longer, healthier life? Okay, let's go ahead and meditate. But again, there's so many different ways to meditate. And that means so many different things for so many different people. And that's one of the reasons why I love some thought meditation and I've integrated that into body, mind, IntelliSense is that it's a very moving form of meditation. So it's, again, obviously Qigong is movement. That is one of the founding pillars of what Qigong is movement along with present moment awareness and intentional breathing. But this meditation style allows us to step away from our thinking brain and connect with our intuitive or our gut brain, and allows movement to bubble up from there. And as that movement bubbles up from your senses, from your way of being, and is not driven by your intellect, tremendous amounts of healing take place because the movement is attentive to that energy flow in the body, the chi that's in the body. So it's really powerful stuff.
And then there is another area that you're an expert in, and that is compassion. You mentioned this compassion cultivation training. When you think about it, what are some misconceptions about compassion that you often encounter?
Oh gosh, there's a lot there. One of them is, and this one I work with a lot, the idea that self-compassion is selfish. It's not. Self-compassion is not selfish at all. Self-compassion gives you the freedom to love and appreciate yourself as you are, so that as you move into that space of self-compassion, you can then be of service better to everyone else. So, taking care of yourself and being kind to yourself has nothing to do with selfishness at all. It has to do with your ability to be a better human for the whole rest of the world. That's a big one. And then another one that I work with quite a bit is compassion for people we find to be difficult. And often it's really easy. We get entrenched in our own little positions and we lose the ability to extend compassion to people we find to be difficult. And, you know, I mean, I was actually just having a conversation about this with someone the other day who was stuck in a past pattern and angry about past events and slightly vengeful. And the reality is, no matter what kinds of thoughts, icky thoughts, she was thinking about the other person doesn't know that. They don't even care. The only one that it's causing harm is the one who's thinking the icky thoughts. So this idea of being able to extend compassion to people that you find to be difficult, the biggest gift is the freedom it gives to you. But then the other thing, the definition that came out of the compassion cultivation training program that I found to be so effective is the idea that compassion has three components. The first is you have to be aware of the suffering or distress in either yourself or someone else. So there's awareness. There's so much going on in the world that's really awful that we can't be aware of it all. We would be a giant puddle of goo if we were attentive to all the suffering in the world. So compassion comes from an awareness. The second piece is that you have to be emotionally moved by what you're aware of. So I can be aware of a certain level of ick going on in the world, but I'm not emotionally moved by all of it. If I were, again, I would be a big puddle of goo. Like right now, there's wildfires raging in Los Angeles. And I can be aware of those fires raging, but I cannot be emotionally moved by the hundreds of thousands of people that are evacuated. I can be emotionally moved. This is actually a really good example. I can be emotionally moved on behalf of my family members who are evacuated, my family members who have loved ones who've lost homes. So there's a finite group of four people. And then the third component of compassion. So there's awareness, there's being emotionally moved, and the third component is taking action. This is where you separate away from empathy, which is in that second zone. And if you stay with empathy, it can be overwhelming. But as soon as you choose to take action, then you're no longer wearing the weight of that empathy. And action can be as simple as wishing someone well. Or in my case, and that's all I can do for my loved ones that are in LA right now. is wish them well. If they and open myself to the idea, if you need anything that I can offer you, let me know. Other than my prayers, other than my well wishes, other than checking in with you every morning saying, I love you, I hope you have a good day. So those are the three components of compassion. Now, I don't know anyone that's personally affected by the war in Ukraine or this, that, or the other. So I am less compassionate towards that, which doesn't mean I'm not a compassionate person. It just means that it's not my job. There are other beings in the universe who are extending compassion to the people in the Ukraine. I don't know anybody there. Another really great example of an aha around compassion is the recognition that compassion doesn't mean fixing someone else's problems all the time. Sometimes compassion means holding space for a person when they figure it out for themselves, even if it's painful for you to watch them struggling and growing. And I have a whole nother story I could tell about that, but then I'll give away all my secrets.
Don't do that. Wow, that's really powerful. So let me come to my last question then, because there is so much insight in you, and we won't get it all today, that's for sure. But I would be interested in what does living a life filled with joy and purpose mean to you? And how your definition of these evolved over time.
Oh, that's great. So in the moment, at this very moment, while I'm talking to you, and it could change tomorrow, it could change in 5 minutes, but living a life full of joy and purpose is, again, going back to what you said about being free from the inside out. I am filled with gratitude. I live in a place that I love. The nature is very beautiful and very nurturing. I can just look out my window and go, ah, because there's foothills and water and farm fields right out my window. And that to me feeds my soul. So knowing what feeds my soul is part of what creates that joy. And then the purpose, living that life of purpose, is for me in this moment, is figuring out how I can be my best self so I can be of support to others learning how to be their best selves. That for me is my life of purpose. So living a life of joy and purpose is making sure that I'm taking care of myself, being compassionate with myself, so that I can be of service to others. Now, living a life of joy and purpose at a different time in my life. So when I was at Google, I was a massage therapist there, and it was the world's best massage job ever. And that was, let's say, 10 years ago. So maybe my life of joy and purpose there was the joy was going to a job every day that I loved and having that financial security of knowing that I had this paycheck coming in all the time. And my purpose was, again, being able to serve people. That is simply how I've been born into this life, is to be of service. I've known that for years and years, different ways, you know, but being able to be of service to the people at Google through the massage that I offered, being able to be of service to my family by having a stable, regular income. And then ultimately, and interestingly, that sense of purpose a decade ago, 15 years ago at Google, it shifted into creating the foundation for what I do now, in that the people who would come to me for massage usually came because they were stressed out and their stress was causing them to have soft tissue challenges. And I thought, you know, wouldn't it be an amazing gift to teach these people how to be less stressed? And so that's how I started teaching meditation and Qigong at Google in 2011, was because I wanted to give people some tools that they could use for themselves to manage their own stress
Mm.
so that they would feel better in their body, so that they too could live a life of joy and purpose without hurting all the time.
Oh, wow. And what would be your advice for someone who has not yet found their purpose, who is struggling or is unsure about that?
Oh, interestingly, I would say find someone like you, find someone like me, and end up spit or anyone, find a mentor or a guide who is steeped in meditative or thought or movement traditions and get one-on-one coaching. And I think, and this, I'd never said that aloud until just this moment, but what I'm learning is you can pick up a book and you can read the book, but it's not the same. The reason why my life has been transformed by this Samphat meditation is I go spend a weekend or a week with my teacher once or twice a year so that I can ask questions, I can learn, I can grow. And then I'm not just reading a book, I'm integrating that into my daily life. So if you haven't found your joy and your purpose, talk to people. And finding the right person is like finding the right healthcare provider or finding the right massage therapist. It's totally fine to go talk to a handful of different people. Find the one that fits until you go, oh, this is it. This is what I want to do. This is how I want to learn and grow. And the other piece is don't give up. If you haven't found it yet, don't think that you can't, because you can. And don't think that it's going to happen immediately, because it takes work and it takes time. And I'll add one more really quick story here. In the book that I wrote, which is Cultivating Compassion, part of the introduction includes a story by a man named James Doty, who's affiliated with Stanford University. And he would say to people who'd come see him, okay, you want a quick fix? You want a pill? You want to fix your life without having to put any effort into it? Here. And he'd hand them a pill jar filled with M&Ms. Or something that was not clearly labeled an M&M, but it was nothing more than a piece of candy. And he'd say, okay, what you need to do with this prescription is to take one of these every day. And then the only way that this pill is going to work is if you sit still for 15 minutes. You don't read, you're not on a device, you're not doing anything. But sitting and being with yourself and letting your body absorb the power of this pill. And so it was his way of teaching people and prescribing the idea of sitting down for 15 minutes. He didn't say meditate. He wasn't telling him to meditate. Maybe they were, maybe they weren't. Maybe they were resting. Whatever it might be, but they were spending 15 minutes with themselves every day in order for this pill, in order for this prescription to work. And he found it to be super effective. So if you don't have the resources to find someone to talk to, if you don't know where to go, choose to get yourself a bag of M&Ms, put them in a little pill jar, and say for yourself, this is my medication. Amy's prescription is I'm going to take one of these a day and sit with myself for 15 minutes and see what happens.
That is the perfect advice and also perfect ending to a perfect conversation. Thank you so much, Amy. It was so insightful to listen to you. You're just a treasure trough of insights and
Oh,
knowledge. Thank you so
well.
much.
Thank you for hosting this podcast and being out there every week for people to come and listen to and learn from. And I am honored and grateful to be able to spend this time with you today.
Thank you. And thank you to all of you watching this or listening to this. Bye. Bye, Amy.
Bye.
This was Lead Well. Now, what is the one thing that you're taking away from this episode? Please share in the comments below and do share the podcast with your friends and family, but only if you like it.